This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Sabra Lane. The union movement is pushing a bold plan to negotiate wage deals across entire sectors. It'd mean companies in the same industry would sign up to a single enterprise bargaining agreement. But some business groups say it's a throwback to the 1960s. And it also means there'll be some awkward discussions at the federal government's job summit next week. Political reporter Claudia Long has more.
As unions push to strike pay deals covering multiple workplaces, ACTU Secretary Sally McManus says there's a major motivation.
It's 10 years of wages going nowhere. Part of the reason, well, the main reason why wages have collapsed is because collective bargaining's collapsed.
The ACTU wants more groups of workers to be able to bargain with several employers, known as collective bargaining, rather than workers just negotiating with their individual bosses.
Enterprise bargaining should still stay as well, but there's a big group in the middle at the moment that are effectively locked out.
Sally McManus says it's people in smaller workplaces and care sectors, which are often dominated by women, who need access to the collective bargaining system.
What is the answer to pay rises? If we do not fix the bargaining system, if we do not give workers the ability to be able to win pay rises.
But not all business groups are keen on multi-employer bargaining. Innes Willicks is the chief executive of the Australian Industry Group.
This is a retrograde step. It's sort of trying to throw Australia back into a 1960s economy. No two businesses are the same. They're not the same in terms of output, in terms of size, in terms of geography. And to sort of throw a blanket over all of them would be a recipe for disaster.
And he thinks the federal government should think twice before considering the ACTU proposal.
Quite frankly, agreement around that is impossible.
Instead, the Australian Industry Group has bowled up its own idea.
What we're after more than anything else is a stripping out of the complexity and the technicality here while providing very clear safety nets for workers and employers around how a system would work.
That's something the Australian Chamber of Commerce would also like to see. Andrew McKellar is the chief executive.
The system has become too complex. We've got to have simple rules that the commission can follow that apply to everybody.
And the Chamber also isn't keen on the union call for multi-employer bargaining.
We want to see some measures that will be able to be applied very quickly and very practically to address the fundamental supply-side shortages that Australia has at the moment. We also then want to see some longer-term ideas being contemplated.
Sally McManus isn't fazed by the business sector's stance.
I mean, we shouldn't be surprised or naive about this. I mean, some employer lobbyists would like things to stay as they are because sometimes, you know, their profits, their bonuses, the CEO bonuses are tied to profit.
So will the Albanese government embrace the ACTU's ideas?
They were elected on a mandate to get wages moving. You need to have a critical mass of people who can collectively bargain to push wages up.
ACTU Secretary Sally McManus ending Claudia Long's report. While multiple industries are crying out for workers, some skilled migrants have been waiting for years for their visa applications to be processed. Engineers are among those struggling with delays, prompting a warning that further holdups could frustrate big infrastructure projects and the expansion of the clean energy industry. John Daly reports.
Hello.
Hello, Abdo.
Yes, good morning, sir. Nice to see you.
Calling from Kenya, Yemeni engineer Abdo Taher says he's been waiting 3 years for his chance to come to Australia.
I am coming and I'm trying to get a new opportunity, a new golden chance. That is now what I'm fighting for. It's like a dream that we are trying professionally, politely, asking the local authorities. We need an answer of why we have been getting that kind of visa delays.
The 27-year-old was a recent industrial engineering graduate when he first applied for the temporary 18-month 476 visa in May 2019. He's been waiting ever since.
For me, I was thinking that I'll only be taking 6 months to 8 months, like how the old applicants used to take. So I had my plan and I had my future planned. But unfortunately, all of that has stopped.
Abdo is now working in Kenya, but he's not the only foreign engineer waiting for a decision from immigration authorities. Pakistani electrical engineer Abdullah Akund is biding his time too, although he says others have given up on their Australian dreams.
If you talk to other people who are waiting from 2019 or 18, They express their depression in a very bad way. I wish that Australian government listen us. They are really, really disappointed because they are waiting so long. Like 3 years is not easy.
Abdullah Akund and others are lobbying more than half a dozen federal ministers, urging the new Labor government to finally give 476 visa applicants an answer. Their social media campaign, hashtag 476 visa, has been trending on Twitter in Pakistan.
Like now we don't know anything. Like we don't have any answer. When will we get our visa? It will take 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. I don't have any clue. It's very depressing now.
The chief executive of Engineers Australia, Romilly Maju, says more than half of engineers working here are from overseas, making skilled migration critical.
The skills shortage is quite acute. We need 50,000 engineers in the coming years and 100,000 in the next decade. What is driving the demand for engineers in Australia is one is the increased infrastructure pipeline that we have off the back of the stimulus projects from COVID. Secondly is the energy transition and the unique skills that are required in the transition.
And she says there'll be consequences if more visas aren't approved.
This skill shortage will see major project costs and time blowouts. So it will have an impact on the economy and it'll have an impact on the productivity of what we can deliver in Australia.
The ABC has contacted the Department of Home Affairs and the Office of the Immigration Minister, asking how many skilled work visas are waiting for approval and what classes are most affected. We haven't received a response.
John Daly reporting. Would you take money out of your retirement fund to pay for surgery if you had no other choice? Tens of thousands of Australians have been doing just that, withdrawing nearly $1.6 billion from their superannuation to cover medical treatments during the past 3 years. The figures obtained by the ABC show the amount of super released on medical grounds is now almost 20 times higher than in 2010. Political reporter Stephanie Dalzell has this exclusive report.
At just 37 years old, Natalie Dunn is in constant agony. She has endometriosis, an often painful and debilitating condition where tissue similar to the lining of the uterus grows outside of it.
I experience pain with my cycle, but because I also have it up in my chest area, I also experience shortness of breath and sometimes lung collapses, coughing up blood. It's sometimes quite a scary thing to have.
Having spent tens of thousands of dollars on three previous surgeries to treat her crippling condition, the Canberra public servant's now considering withdrawing from her super to pay for a fourth. It's likely to cost about $10,000 in the private sector, but she believes there's no other option.
It's extremely frustrating if you go public. You sometimes are looking at an 18-month, two-year wait for your surgery, which is a really long time when you're in pain.
Superfund members are allowed to apply to the tax office for early access to some of their retirement savings under compassionate grounds. In the 2011 financial year, the ATO approved the release of about $25 million for medical reasons. But by the 2020 financial year, which includes the first few months of the pandemic, it had approved $476 million. Honorary Enterprise Professor at the University of Melbourne, Stephen Duckett, is outraged.
Australia's Medicare system means that people shouldn't have to raid their own savings to get the care they need. We should have a system where people can get access to elective procedures in a timely way, be it in the public or the private sector.
Overall, between July 2018 and December 2021, almost $1.6 billion was approved for release on medical grounds, with just over 100,000 claims. As Australian Medical Association President Steve Robson explains, the reasons why people take money from their super for treatment vary, but include dental work, bariatric surgery and IVF.
I think it is concerning. That's a lot of money and that's a lot of people's future that's being taken out of what should be an investment for their retirement and being used now. So I think it's an important issue.
In a statement, a spokesman for Assistant Treasurer Stephen Jones says the government has no current plans to change the rules around compassionate early access for superannuation, while Shadow Health Minister Anne Rustin says all Australians have the right to access their super to help pay for medical treatments.
Stephanie Dalzell reporting there. Surging demand for electric vehicles around the globe is fueling an investment boom in the minerals used in the rechargeable batteries that power the cars. Experts say Australia's in pole position to capitalise on the shift, given its abundant reserves of every one of the minerals needed. But they warn if Australia wants to become a battery mineral superpower, it'll need to be more than just a quarry to the world. Energy reporter Daniel Mercer has the story.
As he sits behind the wheel of his car, Harold Murphy talks excitedly about the technology at his fingertips.
So that basically goes from zero to sort of 50 k's an hour.
The 58-year-old is one of a small but rapidly growing number of motorists driving an electric vehicle, or EV. He's a massive fan.
It's great. Look, I've got the slowest version you can get, and it does 0 to 105 seconds.
Less than 2% of new car sales in Australia in 2021 were electric, but that's expected to surge in coming years. Harold Murphy, a semi-retired IT professional, likens the change to another technological revolution.
It's a little bit like, you know, everyone had a conventional mobile phone, say like a Nokia, and we all loved them, we thought they were great. And then Apple came out with this strange flat screen, no tactile feedback smartphone. And for a while, a lot of people sort of looked at it and went, well, that's not really for me. But look, 13 years later, everyone's got one. And that's exactly what's going to happen with EVs.
The uptake of EVs is driving booming demand for the minerals used to make the cars. Happily for Australia, all of those minerals are found here, fueling hopes the country can become an EV mineral superpower. Alison Britt is from Geoscience Australia.
We're really lucky in Australia. We have the most amazing natural endowment of all of these battery minerals. In fact, when it comes to world rankings, we're in the top 10 for all of them. And for most of them, we're even in the top 3.
Lithium is the best known, but nickel, cobalt and manganese are all found in abundance in Australia. At the Murrin Murrin mine in Western Australia's goldfields, mining giant Glencore produces two of them, nickel and cobalt. Jason Cook from Glencore says the mine's cobalt production alone amounts to about 5% of global supply.
By 2050, we see demand for nickel and cobalt quadrupling from today. And we also see the need for supply of copper and zinc to double by 2050. So basically, we see a strong demand for all of those minerals into the future.
Alison Britt from Geoscience Australia says the bigger rewards are in processing and manufacturing.
If you want to compare an EV battery to cooking, we have all of the ingredients to make a delicious cake in our pantry. And the challenge for Australia, the question that we need to be asking ourselves right now is, do we want to continue doing what we have been doing? Do we want to continue selling some of those ingredients to cake makers overseas? Or do we want to take that next step?
Whatever happens, consumer Harold Murphy reckons the switch to EVs is inevitable.
There's a point of inflection. You can see it now. You can't drive very far, you know, on any sort of road trip and not see an EV on the road. Whereas a couple of years ago, you know, they were extremely rare. People's acceptance has just completely changed.
Electric car owner Harold Murphy ending Daniel Mercer's report. As flood-affected homeowners in the Northern Rivers region of New South Wales wait for more details about government buybacks and land swaps, there are fears renters are being forgotten. In Lismore, rents have soared since floodwaters swallowed parts of the city 6 months ago, leaving some locals displaced and others facing desperate situations. Nell Whitehead reports.
It wasn't easy for Rebecca Rushbrook to find a home to rent in Lismore, even before the floods.
You'd go to an open house and there'd be a line of 40, 50, 60 applicants down the street.
And since the house went under 2 metres of water, finding a new one has been even harder.
Now that the flood has wiped out, I think it's 4,000 homes. It's made it 100 times worse because all of these homeless people and no homes for them to go into.
Rebecca and her family moved around for months before a friend offered a longer-term solution.
She very kindly and responsibly rented me her place for normal pre-flood rent amount, not these insane rents that we've got post-flood, because otherwise I was applying for places that were $600, $650 a week with no flipping idea of how the hell I was going to pay that rent once I got one.
She's one of the lucky ones. The floods have left Lismore facing a rental disaster. Rents overall have risen more than 13% over the year to July, according to the property data company CoreLogic. Unit rents are up over 18%. Cathy Serventy manages housing and homelessness operations at Social Futures, a non-profit in Lismore.
I think somebody said the other day, we had a crisis and now we have a catastrophe. And that is absolutely true.
Prices were first pushed up during the pandemic as investors cashed in on low interest rates and people moved to the regions. But Cathy Cervantes says the floods created a perfect storm, which has made it almost impossible for low-income earners to find a rental.
People who are rebuilding, some of them are renting, so that's taken a certain proportion of the rentals. The kind of the cheaper areas, this is where the low socioeconomic people were, the South Lismore, the North Lismore. So all those rentals, people's granny flats down the back of their houses, they're gone.
About 1,300 flood-affected people are still in emergency accommodation 6 months on. Some families have left the region and others are resorting to desperate measures.
People are squatting in empty houses. People who had rentals and they're just squatting in empty houses. So they're living in places with no power, no sanitary and sometimes, you know, no lockable doors.
Renters are eligible for assistance. They can get a one-off $5,000 payment from the state government for costs towards repairing or replacing household items or moving them to a new home. Ellie Bird is the director of Resilient Lismore, a community-run disaster response network. With the odds of a third La Nina now shortening, tenants are worried about what lies ahead.
So we know that the lowest socioeconomic people in our community live in the flood zone. And of course, the compounding factor that we're going to see now, because there is no effective response as far as temporary accommodation or longer term accommodation goes, is that those people will go back into the flood zone as more housing is brought back online in the flood zone. They'll go back in and they face a higher risk of being impacted again should there be a subsequent event.
That's Ellie Bird from Resilient Lismore, ending Nell Whitehead's report. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has told the UN Security Council that Russia must withdraw from a nuclear power plant and stop what he describes as nuclear blackmail. The comments came during Ukraine's Independence Day celebrations, with Western nations marking the occasion by announcing more military support for the country in its fight against Russia. Europe correspondent Steve Kinnane reports.
At a solemn ceremony in Ukraine's capital, President Zelensky handed out awards for heroism to family members of those killed in combat. On the 31st anniversary of his nation breaking away from the Soviet Union, he paid tribute to those who continued to fight for independence. I would like to thank you for our independence, he said. Half a year of a violent, full-scale war, 8 years of our country's heroic defence during the war in Donbass in the east, a generational fight for Ukraine. Later, in a speech to the UN Security Council, President Zelensky warned that Russia had put the world on the brink of a radiation catastrophe by turning the territory around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant into a war zone. He called on the International Atomic Energy Agency to take permanent control of the site and called on Russia to withdraw from the plant. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told the UN Security Council that the safety of the power plant must be guaranteed.
The warning lights are flashing. Any actions that might endanger the physical integrity, safety or security of the nuclear plant are simply unacceptable. Any further escalation of the situation could lead to self-destruction. The security of the plant must be ensured and the plant must be re-established as purely civilian infrastructure.
Both the US and the UK use Ukraine's Independence Day to announce further military aid packages. And there was a surprise visit to the capital from one of President Zelensky's strongest allies, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson. He paid tribute to the sacrifice of the Ukrainian people.
Because out of the ashes of your towns and cities, out of the monstrous scars that are being left by Putin's missiles, something beautiful is blooming, and it's a flower that the whole world can see and admire. And that is the unconquerable will of the Ukrainians to resist.
In what is likely to be Boris Johnson's last visit to Ukraine as Prime Minister, President Zelensky presented him with the country's Order of Liberty. This is Steve Kinnane reporting for AM.
That's AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Sabra Lane.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast.
Solicitor General may have found Scott Morrison's secret ministerial power grab was irresponsible rather than illegal. The government thinks there's much more to uncover yet, which it hopes to do through a full-blown inquiry. Today, the host of Insiders, David Spears, on the forensic examination to come. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.